welcome to the Semiconductor Insiders Podcast Series. The goal of this podcast is to bring semiconductor experts together to get to the truth about the matter at hand. We'll get right to the point and not exceed 30 minutes of your time. If you have a topic you would like us to cover, please post it on semiwiki.com and we'll get right to it. Good morning. My guest today is Rich Golden, a good friend of mine and definitely one of the most interesting guys in EDA. Good morning, Rich, and Happy New Year.
Good morning, Dan. Happy New Year to you.
Rich is also a fellow boater, so we're both on the water today. Hey, Rich, let's start out with what originally brought you to semiconductors.
Okay, well, way back in high school, I took one of the very first computer science classes, and it was then that I knew that I wanted to be in computers. So I went to Syracuse University to get my degree in computer science. And following that, there are just a few high-tech companies that I was interested in working for. I think Texas Instruments, Digital, and IBM. And I ended up at Texas Instruments, moving from Syracuse down to Texas, where it's a little bit warmer.
Yeah, I agree. I ended up in California. I had the same experience. I started in high school, but California was supposed to be. So I started in Silicon Valley. But, you know, you came to TI as an interesting period, right? That was the period Morris Chang was there. Wally Rhines, did you know Morris and Wally?
Yeah, that's right. We were just starting into ASIC at that point, and I was working for Wally. Yeah, of course, that was several layers down, but being involved in the beginning of ASIC and working in Wally's organization was just a great start. And the people that I met at Texas Instruments, I stayed with a lot of them throughout my career. You know, there's a reason they call TI Training Institute, because people go from there to all the other companies. But we were pioneering standard cell at the time, and we thought that everything was going to move over to standard cell. And the other guys like LSI Logic were doing Gatorade. They were down the wrong path. Well, that turned out not to be quite correct. And, Gatorade really was the big winner there. Although we learned a lot. I ended up being manager at Texas Instruments for the workstation library. So I think TI figured out real fast that I wasn't that great a programmer. Maybe we should try me in management and see how that goes. But we were working with Daisy and Mentor and Valid back then. And it was pretty cool organization, because it was kind of like a Jay Leno garage for all the workstations. So every new workstation that came out, we had to support. And, you know, Daisy had the proprietary workstation, and Valid had the Scout Star. We had the old Apollo locomotive engines for Mentor. So whenever anyone came to visit a TI, they would tour them through our group.
Oh, so that's how you got into EDA. You know, I had a similar experience.
Yeah, so yeah. I got into EDA because I was working in semiconductor and ASIC, and I was dealing with all the EDA companies. And at the time, you know, I was maybe a little bit naive or new, but I viewed it as the same interest industry. Semiconductor and EDA is just one industry.
I had the same experience. I worked for a computer company, and our computer hardware was used for EDA in Silicon Valley. So I just learned real quickly that software was a place to be. So I jumped from hardware to software, and a good time to jump, though, because at that time, the hardware got real cheap with the Microvax and the Sun Microsystem workstation. So EDA treated me well.
Right. I remember when we got our first Microvax, it was at one MIPS. It was incredibly fast.
Yeah, and it didn't fill a whole room.
That's right, exactly right. One of the interesting things that happened at TI was one day my boss came to me and said, hey, do you want to start up the ASIC division in India for TI? I said, sure. And so, although I didn't start the site in India, I started the ASIC division there, and I was only like 25 years old at the time, and ended up going to India like every quarter for many, many years. And that was quite a different experience back then, because there really weren't multinationals in India at the time. Texas Instruments, along with HP and Motorola, were really the first ones in there. So India was a very different place back then. I remember our satellite dishes coming in on the oxen cart, blow them up.
Well, I tell you, TI's, he's still huge in India. I see the traffic from SemiWiki from TI India, and about 10% of our traffic is from India. So AMD, Intel, TI, everybody is in India. So it looks like you started a pretty big trend.
Yeah, I was told, go to India this week and hire 25 people. And I did. And some of the people that I hired are still there and are the management of the site right now.
That's crazy. So why did you leave TI and go to Synopsys? I think you went.
Yeah, so Tifeng Chen recruited me to Synopsys. I had been to Silicon Valley many times visiting the EDA companies, and it really wasn't something that I was that interested in moving to Silicon Valley, because to me it was just all these bland two-story buildings and all these campuses. But to me, Synopsys was the one company in EDA that, one, had all quality people that I worked with, and two, met their commitments. When they said they were going to do something, they did it. And so Tifeng Chen recruited me to be the engineering manager for their semiconductor vendor program. So working back with the semiconductor vendors to build libraries for Synopsys. And I thought that was somewhere that I could contribute well to. And so that's why I decided to go to Synopsys.
Well, you spent, what, 20 years there? Maybe more?
Yeah, it was actually 23 years. So when I started at Synopsys, we had, I think, revenue was $65 million, and there was 300 people at Synopsys. And when I, through my tenure, we grew up to a $2 billion company with 10,000 people. So I saw a lot of changes at Synopsys, a lot of good growth there.
Yeah, you guys made some key acquisitions, and you know, as EDA is known for, but Synopsys made some really big ones. I worked for a couple of companies that was acquired. So I worked for Avante, you know, even though that had some controversy around it, I thought that was a key acquisition for Synopsys. And of course, I worked for Viraj Logic. And in fact, you know, was Synopsys in Armenia before Viraj, or were they in the media at the same time? Because Viraj had a layout in Armenia.
That's right. So those were a couple of very interesting acquisitions. Avante was really key because it was clear that you needed to connect layout to synthesis and design. And Synopsys at the time was nowhere there, and there wasn't really a way to catch up to Cadence. And Avante did that trick for them. So that was really important so that they could have a full flow. On Viraj, that's another really key acquisition on the IP side. Viraj was in Armenia, and it ended up being one of the key components of the Synopsys Armenia site, which I ended up running. So we actually acquired four companies very much at the same time in Armenia. Viraj was not the first one. There was a library company that we acquired there first, and we added Viraj to it very, very soon after. And that created a site in Armenia that was very focused on IP development and now is a key component of Synopsys, their success in IP. Because when you do IP, especially things like SerDes and very complex mixed signal IP, you really need a source of very highly skilled engineers that are low cost compared to US in order to do all the porting to all the different processes that you need. And Armenia fits that bill very, very well because Armenia during the Soviet Union was the center of semiconductor. And there's a lot of engineers there that have that kind of experience. And Armenians just tend to be very, very intelligent and very well-suited for engineering work. And so,
yeah, you know, Rich, one day, you know, Rich, yep. You know, Rich, hang on a second. you know, we had groups in, Viraj had groups in India and Armenia doing similar things, layout and such. And the India group had really high turnover. I mean, it was ridiculously high. But the Armenian group didn't. No turnover except for one guy died. But that was it. And it was just amazing to work with those guys. And, you know, they were mathematicians, I think, primarily. Or that's where their root was. But, amazing guys.
Yeah, they're just terrific. And, you know, the Armenian people in general are just so welcoming and friendly. And it was a great experience for me. Probably the most impactful experience I've had in my career. So one day, how it started was I was sitting in my office. My boss, John Chilton, came to me and said, "Rich, do you want to go to Armenia with me?" And I said, "Yes," immediately. And then the next thing I said, "Well, where's Armenia?" I didn't even know where to locate it on a globe. But we went over there, and I ended up working on, like I said, those four acquisitions. And we built a really good site there as the CEO of Synopsis Armenia, I think, for 8 years. And we built an organization of over 400 engineers. And the interesting thing was, you know, Armenia is a small country, and they were just emerging from the Soviet Union, and the country was really struggling. And everything that Synopsis did in Armenia, we were the largest multinational in that country, had an impact on the millions of people that live in Armenia. It's only a, you know, very small millions of people, but we had an impact on that country. It was very different from any other site we had. You know, the Synopsis site in China, for example, can't really make a big impact on what happens in China. But in Armenia, we could. So we had to manage this thing very, very differently and look at what our moves, what we did in Armenia, the impact that it had on that country. So I worked very closely with the president and the prime minister and a lot of the business community and the university to build a high-tech economy, basically because we needed it around us. You know, we couldn't have our support for our machines coming from Kazakhstan. You know, we needed it right there in Armenia, and it wasn't there. I wanted to bring our Silicon Valley culture to Armenia, which back then I think had a little bit better reputation than Silicon Valley culture does today. But one of, you know, everybody has the opportunity to prove themselves, one that is free from corruption and bribery, which happened in Armenia at the time. And we worked very hard to make community service something that was acceptable there. And we did a lot of work like that. I developed a new university program around microelectronics so that we could graduate students from that with those skills that we could then hire. So that was, you know, that was just a really great opportunity, and the impact that we had was really gratifying.
Yeah. I had always heard that. I also went to Armenia back then, and I had also heard you were somewhat of a royalty back there. What's up with that?
Yeah. Well, I was quite well known in the country. I did a lot of TV interviews and newspaper. I was very often in the newspapers and all. And it was because I was trying to impact things in the country. That's why I kept such a high profile there. I garnered a nickname of the King of Armenia. John Biggs, who was one of the founders of ARM, he actually printed up my picture on some Armenian currency, and that kind of got around. It was a very fun time. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah. Hey, listen, one of the other things I want to talk about just quickly is the book you collaborated on with Neil Armstrong, Stephen Hawking, and the lead guitarist of Queen. I'm just amazed by that. Can you give me the short version?
Yeah, Dan, I'm amazed by that myself. So the name of the book is Starmus, Starmus. I recommend it. Everybody who are listening to this goes out to Amazon and buys a copy. It happened that Brian May, who's the lead guitarist in Keen, and Derek Israelian, who is the astrophysicist who discovered how black holes are formed, they decided that we needed to have a celebration of the 50th year of manned space travel, which was, from the 60s. And so they had this festival in Tenerife in the Canary Islands and invited a whole lot of astronauts and cosmonauts and Nobel Prize winners and astrophysicists to come and give talks at this festival. And also to do a concert with Brian May and Tangerine Dream and Cosmic Sounds. And so this was an incredible festival of people like Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin and George Smoot, who won the Nobel Prize for the Big Bang Theory, and Alexei Leonov, who was the first man to walk in space. And Derek Israelian happens to be Armenian. And so we connected, and he asked me to do a talk at this festival, which was shocking to me. And he asked me to do a talk on semiconductors in space travel. And so I joined with all these wonderful people like Jim Lovell and Charlie Duke, and just on, and gave a talk at this festival in the Canary Islands. Now, following that, and so I got to know all these people. In fact, I worked pretty closely with Neil Armstrong later on a biography, I think. We put our talk into a chapter in a book, and we put all the chapters together, created this book called Star Month, which is just an awesome book by all these wonderful authors. And the chapter in there on semiconductors and space travel is by me. And it happens to be the seminal piece on semiconductors and space travel, I think primarily because nobody else has ever written on that subject. So I guess that piece.
Well, so I just ordered a book. So.
Okay, great. Yep.
I just
go to Amazon.com. read the review because it says some of the greatest thinkers in the world and has my name on there, which I think is kind of a misleading, but okay. Everyone go and order that book off of Amazon. Yeah, it's shocking to me.
EDA has done well for you. So, Rich, look at EDA. You're still in EDA. You left Synopsys. Okay. You went to a startup, and you were acquired, and you're now at Ansys, which is a great company. And, look at EDA and look at the numbers. You know, we've been here since the beginning, and you know, we were struggling in the early days with single digit numbers and flat years and stuff. But look at the double digits we've been posting over the last few quarters. What do you attribute that to?
I attribute it to bespoke silicon. What's happening now is that big systems companies like Apple and Google and Microsoft and Amazon are discovering that rather than relying on standard chips, they can design their own chips, very, very large system-oriented chips that give them an advantage in their own systems over others. And so we now have a whole new class of customers in EDA that are these systems companies. Tesla is another one. I think the automotive companies will join. And they're doing very complex chips, and very large chips, and they're bringing their system understanding into design of chips. And this is all kind of crashing into 3D IC, which is making this possible. So bigger chips, that are almost systems themselves, and interconnecting chiplets. And it's driving more customers, and it's driving more need for more kinds of EDA. When you design these large system chips of bespoke silicon and 3D IC, you're now bringing in new physics that have to be accommodated for, recognized for, and solved for in these designs, which we didn't have to do before. Physics like thermal and mechanical stress and all different kinds of multi-physics that all have to be solved for together because they're impacting each other. So these are new EDA capabilities that need to be brought together to do 3D IC. So not only do we have for EDA new customers, we also have new capabilities that are required to be brought into the flow. Packaging is another one that I have considered.
Yeah, I agree with that completely. You know, the interesting thing is one of the big drivers is software, because, you know, these guys can start their chips and then they can use emulators and prototypers to develop software hand in hand. And this was a big deal for Apple, of course, because they have a huge software ecosystem that they need to deliver at the same time in the silicon. So, you know, and software is, you know, the software burden of the silicon now is just huge. You know, when I got out of college, there was 10 hardware jobs for every software job. You know, software guys were writing drivers. Now it's probably 100 software guys for every one hardware guy, right? But these other companies are realizing that, you know, hey, we have to develop software too. Automotive, I think Tesla is the Apple, you know, of the automotive world. And Tesla has a huge software group that has to develop in conjunction with their hardware guys. So, you know, people ask, how long is this going to continue? And I think you just have to look at all the electronics manufacturers that can benefit from this co-development of software and hardware and custom silicon. And well, I see a long ramp for EDA in this double digit growth rate.
Yeah, I agree with you. And it's all part of this shift left paradigm, do things earlier in the design flow, including software, which I think shift left was a term that Archegos actually coined, or at least made popular 10 years ago. And it's really come to fruition now.
So Rich, we just collaborated on an article about 5G and the airlines. I mean, this is the nice thing about being in the EDA and semiconductor industry is people are saying airlines are being cautious and flights are being canceled because of 5G. We actually know why. So give me just the quick view. We just published this on SemiWiki last week, so maybe other people have read it, but give us the short course.
Yeah, so it's currently happening where 5G has uses a band that's very close to what the airplanes use during ILS, the instrument landing system. So if they are landing by instrument, the ILS sends out this signal to them that they use to home in on the runway. Well, as it happens, the 5G is a very powerful signal, and it's has a great potential to interfere with that signal coming into the airplane. And so you don't want that interference when you're trying to land a plane and end up going a little too low. So it has the potential, it actually has the potential for really disrupting that landing. So that has to be resolved. And it's unfortunate because we know exactly what that interference can be and how to resolve that. You run simulation for that. ANSYS has tool HFSS, which does that simulation, and you can tell exactly how to resolve that. And it would have been all figured out if the proper simulations had been done running up to now. Now it has the potential for just millions and maybe billions of dollars lost through stock prices that plunged when this came out, retrofitting equipment. There's been canceled airline flights. So we've got quite a bit to work through on this one before we can turn those 5G networks on.
Yeah. So I'm a pilot, but I don't fly jets. But it's actually the radio altimeter that is having a problem. And, you know, it's in a band near 5G. And you know, that there's just some, close harmonic issues. And, you know, the problem is that's the radio altimeter is what you use, you know, when you're landing in weather and such. So it is actually a big deal. So I mean, it's safe to fly. I know they're taking cautions and everything, but you're right. You know, we could have fixed this a long time ago. 5G's been rolling out for years. It's just a shame we missed it.
Right. Well, the short-term solution is that Verizon and AT&T and others who are rolling out 5G are not rolling it out near the airport. So right. I think it's a safe situation, but it's frustrating.
Yeah. Well, Rich, thanks for your time. Happy New Year, and this is a good place to stop, and we'll see you out on the bay.
Great, Dan. See you out there. It was a real pleasure.
That concludes our podcast. Thank you all for listening, and have a great day.